So, what do you want to talk about this week, Wolf?
Memory debugging.
Was that on your list?
That wasn't my list.
Okay.
It was not the top item. And
yeah, you're getting a little sneaky. You've got more than one coming up. So I've got them. Memory debugging. Well, what other kind of debugging you mean? Like, as opposed to what?
As opposed to, like, logic debugging or whatever. Just like, you know, the type of errors you make in terms of overriding buffers, stuff like that.
But isn't that still logic?
No, that's not logic. Well, I mean, yeah, technically, I suppose it is logic, but...
The particular brand of bug where you were memory smashing.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
So, little history lesson before we get onto things that are actually relevant to everyone, because, you know, I like to do that, make everyone suffer. So, back in the day, there was a... on the 68000 Macintosh and the later generations machines, there was... you'd, of course, have... That's like today. We have like nil pointers, right? And back in those days, you'd have nil pointers, but often also nil handles. And it was, of course, a programming error to actually try to write through them. And of course, on modern memory protected Unixy systems, if as soon as you write to address zero, your process is terminated with an error.
Boom.
Yeah, and that's a good thing. We didn't have that in the 68000 days because we didn't have protected memory back then. So there was this program, this init system extension in System 7 parlance, called Mr. Bus Error. And I actually forgot the exact details of it, but it turns out that I found a 1991, it looks like some sort of archive from MacTech magazine, David Dunham, who is still kicking as Radio Free Lunch on Twitter, wrote praising Mr. Bus Error and actually laid out some of the details about how it worked, so I was able to dig that up. And what it did is that it was a system extension that would write a specific value in hexadecimal as F0, F0, F1 at address 0, which is on the classic macOS was not an error at all. You could do that. But basically it was a trap for the unwary that was placed there. On the original 68000 machine, Mac, it was an odd address, and the 68000 did not support odd address access. And I actually, turns out I wrote, I don't know if it was Mac Hack paper or whatever, but at least somehow, I rewrote it like over a decade ago for IBM, and it's called Data Alignment Straighten Up and Fly Right. I'm pretty sure it was for Mac Hack initially, but I modernized it. But of course, that was over a decade ago, so now it's not modern anymore. But it still contains some useful information, so I'll put a link to that. So if you're interested in actual data alignment, which maybe one day we'll talk about, but I get the feeling it's a topic that no one cares about. So, but I care about it so deeply. Chaotic. I apparently wrote an entire paper on it. But so you can read that about how the 68000 didn't support odd memory accesses and how that'd use for memory debugging. And it turns out on the 68020 and 68030, those guys actually had hardware support for unaligned data access. But that hex number that I just read off, if you look at it, it's basically a little over 15 million, and so that ends up being more than the memory was that you could stuff into a Mac back then. So that was guaranteed to cause you to fail. So that was an interesting thing. It got enhanced to another init called Better Bus Error. And
that one I remember.
You remember that? Okay, now we're getting to the error that you remember. And yeah. Better Bus Error was use the same trick. I believe I actually even wrote the same value to address 0. But what it also did is installed a VBL, a vertical blanking interrupt task. This is... this actually kind of ties into your topic if you didn't cheat and actually listed your thing. But of course, with the Macs back then and even iPhones today is that you basically have kind of like the screen refresh. And in the Mac originally, it was obviously a cathode ray tube, and it actually you could an interrupt would fire when it did the vertical blanking when the electron gun starts sweeping the screen. And so this is something that you'd actually want to kind of sync with, and you could quote-unquote race the beam where you could, if you didn't want to have tearing in your graphics and other kind of anomaly graphics anomalies, you could install that. And that was useful for other things, in like better bus error, that it was a kind of generic timing task that you could hook into. And what it would do is that essentially, I don't know what the exact interval was, but probably roughly 30 times a second, probably like 32 or something, it would check to make sure that that value had not been changed, since you couldn't actually detect the write itself. Given the 68,000 hardware, you could basically pull that, and as soon as you've noticed a change, then you'd call debug string and you'd stop the program right away, with the idea that maybe you aren't too far away from where it happened, or at least you know what happened. Greg Marriott ended up enhancing, I don't think he wrote better bus error, but I believe he wrote even better bus error, and as an extension, and it had some other feature that I couldn't even track down, no one cares, so. But if you end up looking for even better bus error, it ended up getting rolled into MaxBug, the Macintosh debugging system back then, and you could even do things like change the polling interval and stuff like that. And there was the problem with even better bus error and its like, and is that it would pretty much crash your software, and that was intentional because you wanted to crash as soon as possible. There's apparently a variant, which I didn't know about until I did research for this episode, called less obnoxious bus error, which I don't know how is less obnoxious, but apparently it was less obnoxious. I think it didn't actually crash your program. Maybe just put up a little window saying, hey, your software sucks or something. And I also learned that there was apparently another variant called Yet Even Better Bus Error, written by Dave Evans, that protected the first 256 bytes of memory to protect. This was on the PowerPC Max, and the idea is that the first 256 bytes of memory were actually the emulated 68,000 exception vectors. So if you overwrote any of those, bad things probably end up happening. So he extended it even more. So that's all. But that's all ancient history.
I think there might have been something similar with the Commodore computers, that the first not page, but maybe the first 256 bytes or 128 bytes were all like zero or something. So there was something special about them that made, when you dereference zero, that it did something special to let you know about it. Something, it sounds vaguely familiar. I don't remember the details anymore. So there might have been other things like that on other platforms.
Yeah, I mean, those exception vectors often lived in low memory. They have to live somewhere, and yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at all. And then so that's the classic Mac stuff that no one uses anymore, ancient history, but I think it's interesting. And so nowadays we have Swift, which now that's the end of my talk, because that solves all manually managed errors.
Yep. Thanks for listening, everybody.
And good night. Those of you still hanging in, this is, I guess, the after dark, where I actually tell you it's dark out there and there are monsters. Monsters are real. So Swift does actually fix entire class of error. I like how they call out unsafe pointers and stuff like that. That's pretty great. But as you mentioned in your ARC episode, which episode 105, the title which shall not be named, they'll appear the word I can never repeat, or even, I don't know if I were able to say it in the first place, but anyway.
Demonolithization?
That's it. Yeah. Yes. It's because Swift uses ARC, and ARC itself it doesn't make the problem go all the way away. So, I haven't used Swift extensively enough yet to know what the issues are and how to go about solving them, but it is ARC underneath, so a lot of the same issues apply. And so, if you haven't switched to Swift yet, there's a bunch of options in Xcode that I'd like to go through and kind of tell you what they do and when you should use them. So this is, nowadays you'd access this by like option clicking on the run button or whatever to get to the scheme editor, and there's like a diagnostics tab. And the first one, which is quite handy, is enable zombie objects. Zombie objects are the very old school way of dealing with these, because back in the, I can't believe I'm saying, back in the MRC, the manual reference counting days, which is still the modern times for a lot of us. It was probably one of the best tools for discovering these types of errors. And zombie objects operate at the ejecta C level, so at a higher level than basically everything else that I'll be talking about here. And the idea here is that when you deallocate an ejecta C object, instead of its memory that's simply being reclaimed and probably end up being used by a short-lived new imposter called probably usually NS string, the object isn't deallocated. It's just the ISA pointer in the object now points to the NS zombie class. And the NS zombie class is designed so that any message you send to it, it will scream. And I forget if it throws an exception or this. I know it definitely prints to the debugger that, hey, you're calling something you shouldn't be calling because this object has gone away. But it's basically a way of putting a tombstone in. Instead of an object that's being reaped, it's you put something in place that will scream when you use it incorrectly. So that makes errors a lot more obvious. I believe it says something like you can basically set a breakpoint if you want to stop it, and then it throws an exception. There's enable scribble. So a lot of these techniques, you'll find that they get repeated. Kind of the idea of poisoning memory making it so that, there's maybe a couple variants of poisoning, but the idea is that kind of making sure you don't depend on data that shouldn't be there. And if you touch something you shouldn't, that you immediately blow up, make errors more obvious. So if you enable scribble, what happens is that it fills allocated memory with hexadecimal AA and deallocated memory with hexadecimal 55. And the idea here is that, in theory, that when you're using malloc, that the block that's handed back to you could be filled with anything. It could be chunks of the stack, could be previous objects, whatever. And you should not rely at all on the contents of the buffer that you've been allocated. Unfortunately, it is somewhat common. It's been probably less common through the years, although maybe I've just gotten a lot better programming through the years. You know, imagine that. That your program will work despite, like, maybe the block you get back is filled with something that in your development it's reproducible, and so you end up having you depend on a chunk of data that's there. That's will not be the case when you actually ship your software, which would be pretty sad. So by enabling scribbling, at least it fills it with, again, these values are reproducible, which is still not ideal, but at least it's not zeros or something like that. And of course, with deallocated memory, that increases your odds that if you let go of a block and let's say then you try to jump through it with a series of pointers, that you'll probably go off to the weeds immediately and you'll crash sooner, which is probably a good thing.
Well, it's breadcrumbs. Mm-hmm. So that it's breadcrumbs or clues, or it's things that are left behind so that you have more of an idea of what happened when something goes wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I should also talk about the downsides of some of these things. Zombie objects, because you are never deallocating objects, your memory will eventually fill up. So this is not something you can leave on all the time for long-lived programs, but it's something that...
Or leave on for end users, for example.
Yes.
Right.
Good point. The enabling scribbling, the downsides of that are, it's pretty low. It's obviously takes more cycles to fill in the memory with data and on allocation and deallocation, but that's really minimal. And so enabling scribbling, and sometimes you actually want the random behavior. But like I said, it's at that point, it's possible that your program will end up relying on your buffer being filled with hexadecimal AA. And that'd be really sad if your bug relied on that for some reason, and so your software works if you only enable scribbling. But it's very lightweight to turn on, so it's one of these things where you can just flip on, pretty much on and off without too much problem. Another option is enable guard edges, which adds guard pages before and after large allocations. So the idea here is that you leverage the virtual memory system, which I said we didn't have protected memory in the classic macOS. Of course, now we do. And the idea is that you can leverage this, and you can mark pages as not readable, not writable, not executable, so that if anything touches it, you immediately fault. The gotcha word here is large allocations. I don't know what that definition is. Maybe I probably could actually do some research or look at source code or something like that to figure it out, but I don't really care. Because there's a better solution here, but you should be aware that's there. There's guard malloc. And guard malloc is probably the first in our heavyweight contenders in terms of finding these class of errors. Guard malloc is makes your program run probably, I don't know, it's, it definitely feels slow. I wouldn't say it's like half the speed, maybe three-fourths of the speed, but it burns the memory like the dickens. And let me tell you how it works, and I'll actually quote from the man page here. The returned address of the allocation is positioned such that the end of the allocated buffer is at the end of the last page, and the next page after that is kept unallocated. Thus, accesses beyond the end of the buffer cause a bad access error immediately. When memory is freed, libgmalloc, which is the other name for guard malloc, deallocates its virtual memory, so reads and writes to the freed buffer cause a bad address error, a bad access error. Bugs which have been difficult to isolate because became immediately obvious, and you'll know exactly which code is causing the problem. So we saw the kind of the scribbling technique, the idea of kind of poisoning memory so that you'll crash later type stuff. The nice thing about guard malloc is that you'll crash instantly and your backtrace will be valid and pointing to the problem, hopefully, the code that caused the problem. Like I said, it's pretty slow, but it's nice thing about it is that, you know, nowadays you even have a nice UI and a Xcode for it. It's when I have like weird random crashers, guard malloc, other than first I run through with zombies, guard malloc is my second tool of choice. It makes your app run a lot slower, but it's found some pretty obscure stuff pretty easily, so it has a good return on investment. It's cheap to turn on, run your program through, try to reproduce the issue, and it's caught a few things of mine. And that would have been really hard to track down otherwise. So it's definitely worth, if you have a weird crasher, try to run it.
And have you needed it in ARC code?
No, I haven't, now that I think about it. But that said, I haven't used guard malloc in a while. Maybe this is because I've gotten ever better at kind of nipping these kind of errors in the bud without before I write them. I don't know. Or maybe I'm just leaking like crazy. I just don't notice anymore. That could be it too. There's also, if you're still using manual reference counting, you could use the leaks tool for general kind of, I guess the leaks tool doesn't really exist anymore, but it used to. And, you could use it for, keeping track of, what memory should be referenced and what shouldn't be. And, there's this other environmental variable you could set, which is called malloc stack logging. And there's a man page called malloc underscore history that you should look up that tells you more information about how to enable it. And I believe instruments basically superseded the leaks tool nowadays.
And yeah, I was just talking about this with the ARC debugging in 105.
Right. Yeah, so that gives you the backtrace, ideally, about who actually allocated the stuff.
Well, and especially in instruments, it will actually show you the instances of it. It will show you all that information that you would only have gotten through logging statements before. It's actually quite handy.
Yeah, good point.
But it's still basically leaks detection because, of course, ARC is not garbage collection. It's not really strong references. It's still references under the hood, just regular references, counting, reference counting.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And the tools reflect that.
I actually created a GitHub gist that includes some bad old code that I would not recommend you use, but I think it might be enlightening for the type of stuff I used to have to do, that demonstrates me overriding retain and release to do basically printf-style debugging of keeping track of when things come and go and when they should be released. And I've used that through the years.
Yep.
For tracking down basically ownership issues of things being over-retained or under-retained, and even use, apparently I have a modern version of it that even uses associated objects and even somehow does weird stuff that looks at the current stack trace for determining when things are auto-released or not. So that I actually forgot I wrote that. So I don't know what wall up I was against for having to write that, but I put it up there for historical curiosity. I don't recommend anyone actually uses. The other big there are two other big containers are Address Sanitizer and Valgrind. And while I'm already at 20 minutes, so I'll try and go through this faster. Address Sanitizer is a project that essentially is supported by Clang and GCC, that it essentially turns pointer reads and writes into function calls that allow you to detect whether the memory you're about to access has been poisoned. And then it maintains this idea of shadow memory. That's basically an efficient way to detect whether your program's main memory has been poisoned or not. And it's I'll link to the Google Code project and the Clang page and the original paper. It makes your software run about twice as slow. And there is, I did mention in Edge Cases 103, a microcosm of security, that there is at least some effort underway to implement it in hardware, which helps with the speed issue. I don't think we'll ever get that in our fancy-dancy MacBooks. It also, I mentioned before that it uses mock override, I think to dynamically override probably malloc and free and stuff like that, or at least it did. I suspect there are probably better ways of doing it now that they have better support in the operating system for this stuff, like dylid overriding perhaps. But anyway, there's also an interesting project associated with Address Sanitizer called Thread Sanitizer, which tries to dynamically detect data races. So that's really interesting. And apparently it's based on a subproject of Valgrind called Hellgrind, but I'll just continue moving on. Valgrind is really interesting from a technical standpoint, that it's kind of like a virtual machine and uses just-in-time compilation techniques, but essentially what it is dynamic binary translation, that it takes your, say, x86 code, and it will read it and will turn it into intermediate representation internally. And then it can, at that point, because it's read the instruction stream and has kind of figured out what your software can do, it can then modify the generated x86 again to insert things anywhere it sees fit and kind of morph it anyway. And it's basically kind of a pluggable architecture that it does the heavy lifting of kind of reading the x86 instruction stream and then writing back out again. And then you have these plugins that can modify, essentially kind of like you can think of it as rewriting an AST, like in like Lisp macros or something like that. And it's even slower than Address Sanitizer. It tends to make your software run about between 1/4 and 1/5 its normal speed. But it can find classes of errors that Address Sanitizer can't. Especially, I believe if you use a value before it's initialized, I believe Valgrind can find that. But I've only used it once in Anger, and it turned out to be a separate bug. It's a bit hard to set up. But that was a while back. It might be easier nowadays. But it's pretty hardcore, and it's computer science wise, it's pretty neat. So if you have a memory smasher or something, some corruption that it's really hard for you to track down, first use guard malloc because it's already built in to the system and it's easy for you to use and all that. And then progressively work up to Address Sanitizer and Valgrind. That's it for me.
From what I remember, Valgrind never got support for garbage collection.
Mm.
And so, you know, people basically, you know, it wasn't much use for people who had garbage collected apps. I wonder if it works with Arc well enough to start using it again for regular Mac apps.
I would think so. I mean, because Arc boils down to reference counting, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although, yeah. I'd be interested. I haven't been keeping up with it since you know, many, many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Alrighty. So yes, I'm going to be talking about what was in my notes, which is a quick look at Async Display Cap, which was announced, a couple of days ago, recently, by Facebook, released by Facebook. And so there's a webpage for it, a website for it, asyncdisplaykit.org. And that website has a link to the GitHub repository for it. And it's introduced in a blog post on the Facebook engineering blog called Introducing Async Display Kit. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And I also, a lot of the content of this, of what I'm going to talk about, is from an NS London video that is linked to from the blog post, where Scott Goodson, who was the manager of the app Paper at Facebook and also worked on the original iPhone software, talks for like an hour on what he was thinking about when they were putting that together and how it works. So the idea here is that he kind of disparaged a little bit the iOS SDK by saying that it was designed to be used in situations where there was not a whole lot of interactivity in animation. And so when you do things like swipe to the left and then that, or you click a button or you tap something in the toolbar and then a view swipes, you know, goes from left to right, a new view comes in, animates in. He says that that was implemented due to hardware limitations of the time as a static animation. You kicked it off and then it finished and then you did something else after that. It wasn't the case where animations where, you know, you were dragging something around and that thing followed your hand or could react to how your finger was moving in a way that would be continuous, that would be ongoing. And he says that now that we have more of that, especially with the sort of physics-based animations, that physics simulating animations that have come up more or less recently, and that Facebook has been trying to use over the last year or so, that you can't rely on that old way of doing things where you just set off an animation and let it go. That now it's actually the hardware can handle better animations and reactive animations, but it's also still a lot more demanding than what we used to do. It's demanding of your infrastructure and it's demanding of your hardware. And what they decided, what they said to themselves, was that they were seeing that they couldn't get the kind of smoothness that they wanted in these very complex animations that they wanted to put together for their apps. And they said, well, a lot of this is coming about because so much of putting together a UI needs to happen on the main thread because of UIKit limitations. And before, that was fine because that's all you had, or because you could put out-of-process animations in because they were static, because they were fire and forget. Nowadays, it all has to be done inside the process, but you've got multiple cores in your iOS devices, so you could, in theory, start to do more work for these animations on another thread, except UIKit won't let you. Mm-hmm. So what they said was, well, after you've optimized as much as you can and do as little work as you want to, what they said was, no, we want to do these ambitious UIs, these ambitious interactive animations. We're not willing to simplify our app so much that it'll be smooth with just one, you know, using one core for the UI. Uh-huh. We want to use all of them. And that's what led to Async Display Kit. They said, how can we put more of that work that right now we have to put on the main thread into other threads, into something that's off the main process? Excuse me, the main thread. And so let's see here. So I watched this video. I also looked at the documentation, and they say that, well, so their idea here is that they introduced, now it's interesting because I took this on not because I'm necessarily going to use it right away, but because it was kind of interesting to compare and contrast with SpriteKit. Because in the same way that SpriteKit introduced a whole new tree of objects that represent what you're going to display on screen, Async Display Kit also introduces, they call them nodes as well, uh-huh, a node tree, which is their basic building block of how this stuff is going to get handled. And in the same way that views can be, well, they are layer backed in iOS, but you can still use layers directly if you want to. They have their node, which is backed by a view, or it could be backed by a layer directly. And so what you do is you say, instead of making views yourself, you make nodes that represent the pieces of your view. And then their code in these node classes deals with displaying it in a way where a lot of that work is taken off the main thread. And so they do this by a couple of ways that they do this. They do this by changing around how displaying logic is handled. So when you set up what you're going to display, you call their APIs to do it, or you implement their APIs to do it, instead of doing it through UIKit. Then they turn around. Now, they still use views, and because it's an iOS framework, it's layers underneath that. Because they say, you know, their goal was not to re-implement UIKit, which is nice. But that means they still need to do some of that work on the main thread. They still need to use views. And some of this I'm not, again, I looked at it for a couple of hours. I'm still not sure how all of it works, because it's actually pretty complicated. But I think what it's doing is, well, and what they say in their docs is that they're doing is they use as lightweight views and layers as they can. They actually have some specific AS display layer and AS display view. These are prepended with an underscore to show that they're private classes you shouldn't screw with. All they do is call back into the node class for things like display. And I'm not sure exactly how they do that. The code is actually fairly complicated and fairly, I wouldn't say necessarily low level, but it's got a lot of stuff going on in there. But I think a lot of it is there such that most of the work of rendering is done, and they say this, is done, can be done in other threads. It's all blocks based. It's all put together in that fashion. And the thing that I'm not quite sure about is how they do that. Because if you're going to draw something in a view, if you're going to draw something in a layer, again, that has to be done in a very specific way. And it seems like what they're doing is they're trying to do, like they talk a lot about text drawing and laying out, measuring and laying out and rendering text, that's very expensive. And so the theory is, well, I think they're doing as much of that or all of that in another thread. And yet text is something that needs to be done in the main thread, some of it anyway. So again, I'm not quite sure how they're doing everything that they're doing. So it can't be a complete episode about it, I guess. You have to look elsewhere. But I do know that it is again, pretty complicated, and they do say that it all kind of works that way. Now, let's see. When I looked at the code, and again, I didn't look at the code completely, what they do is they've got a couple of display methods, which again are different than the methods in the regular UI view or in LayerKit, Core Animation. What's interesting is that they're class-based, so that when you say, I want to display something in a certain way, you provide instance-level, like there's a parameter instance, and that, I guess, has all the information that you need to display what the view needs to display, what the node needs to display. And then that's actually sent to a class method to do its work. I'm not quite sure why they do that, but that is how they do that. And there are two main public node classes. There is a text node and an image node. And the text node, again, they do all this stuff to, they take a attributed string, and then they do all the work to figure out how to lay that out in the space that you provided. And, you know, given the right parameters, you know, the background color or foreground color or something like that. And then there's an image version of it. And those are the two concrete nodes for this. And everything else that's built up is basically built up on those. And I haven't had a chance yet to see. So they're, you know, they don't use any of the UI view class subclasses. They don't use controls. They don't use buttons. They don't use anything else. So how do you draw your own buttons in here? And I think they might be really kind of saved by the fact that in iOS 7, you basically get rid of all that Chrome. So you can make a button now just having some text there. Mm-hmm. And that probably really helped them, because if they had to build up, like, you know, all the button Chrome that you used to have to build up, well, the buttons were always custom in iOS. Mm-hmm. But other things that were there, you know, help me out here. What are some other things that had a lot of Chrome in them? The way, you know, the buttons in a navigation bar, for example.
Yeah.
They were kind of very set up in a very specific way. And if you had to replicate all of that in your own custom drawing, then you kind of have the Java problem, right? Where they were always mimicking standard controls their own way. So they really kind of got lucky when iOS 7 came out. I'm not sure if they've been working on this for 2 years, I think. So I'm not quite sure what they were doing before that.
Which is interesting, because I just looked at the pod spec for the project, and it requires iOS 7.
Yeah. Yeah. So that makes sense. Mm-hmm. With them. So, but you know, that's most of what I've got for now. There are a couple of other things that are interesting that again, you can mostly get from the documentation, but I'll save you a trip to that. One of the other things they say they can do for you is that a lot of people might say, well, I'm going to go down to the layer level for performance reasons. Mm-hmm. But layers, you know, in the same way that I talked about, you know, the sprite kit layer and the UI view layer and the CA layer, they all have different APIs. And I'm seeing a lot of this with SpriteKit as well. I want to move stuff over to SpriteKit. Well, now I have to rewrite all of it. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a pain. And so one of the benefits of using async DisplayKit is that with one property call, I think is layer-backed, you can switch your code from being view-backed to just being layer-backed. Mm-hmm. And then that should save you some performance stuff. Hmm. And another thing that they do, there's another flag you can set on a particular node. And let's see if I have it written down somewhere, where then they will combine all of the children of your node, the child nodes of that node, down to one layer. And they will rasterize that to one layer. And so you can use that if you want to get a lot of performance out of something which isn't going to change very much.
Hmm. Interesting.
So they, and again, I looked at the code. There's a lot of stuff in there. This was made for paper. And so it's working code. But I do have to say that I am a little worried. It's got a lot of interesting stuff in it. It's got a lot of interesting ideas in it. And I actually saw some tweets when it was first announced of people saying, wow, this is so innovative. This is more innovative than what Apple does. Mm-hmm. That may very well be true. But I would be hesitant to do this on a project which I knew I was going to have to keep working on for years and years, that I knew was going to get a lot of maintenance, a lot of new updates, because it is such a you know, left turn for Apple's right turn, for example. So, for example, they don't handle auto layout, because auto layout needs to be done in the main thread. Mm-hmm. And auto layout actually has a lot of logic to it, and the way they described it was auto layout is opaque. And yes, Apple likes giving you new APIs that are opaque that you can't get into, because they don't expect you to be writing your own UI frameworks on top of their stuff. Mm-hmm. And so the problem is that because they're interacting with UIKit in a very particular way, they're going to have to keep updating that for new versions of UIKit, because Apple's going to keep changing things. Apple's going to keep breaking their code. And, you know, the best case scenario is that they keep supporting it. That's it. You know, you have to assume they will keep doing it. But Facebook isn't in the business of continuing to support outdated versions of their own software.
Right.
They're in the business of writing their software. So it's really hard for me to imagine that they'll say, okay, you know what, you planned your code around this version of our framework that we wrote 5 years ago. We're going to keep updating that for new versions of Apple's OS for you, even though we've moved on. Mm-hmm. Which can leave you in a really bad position. And I believe I've talked in the past about my experiences with Mono and Mono Touch, which is, you know, not exactly the same thing, but it's something similar. It's where somebody said, well, we're going to put something on top of what Apple does things very differently, but interacts very closely with it. And, you know, for many years, maybe they finally done it. They didn't have 64-bit support for the Mac stuff. And that can really leave you in a bind if you're like, well, we've made this bet on this code. And so, you know, I've had this problem with other skepticism with other code bases like this. And so, like, Mono has pretty much been a bad bet, I think, for people. Other ones currently, like CocoaPods or Reactive Cocoa, they both seem to be going strong at the moment. Mm-hmm. And maybe they'll keep going strong. But that would be my main concern about this for the moment, is that it's something on top of what Apple's doing. Apple may... It can't use the new stuff that Apple uses that is in conflict with their particular philosophy. And it's a risk for the future. So I would say that if you're interested in it, I know some people who have been playing around with it and have seen their own gains in performance with it. I think probably one of the best things, and we've talked about this before in other cases, is the best case scenario would be Apple taking some hints from this, right? Mm-hmm. There is so much that they do on the main thread. Could they improve that? Could they make that better and give that benefit to more people without you having to make this risky bet in the future? So we'll see. But it's definitely worth taking a look at.
I would say that you kind of made it sound like that maybe 2 or 3 years out, if Facebook didn't keep on revving this, that it would be broken. I don't think it would be flat out broken where your app couldn't work at all anymore. Especially because with the App Store, you have to use public APIs. I think probably what happened is that it'd still work, but you just wouldn't be on the fast path. Like, let's say Apple does their own version of ASIC Display Kit with new classes and new this and that. And now you are in the business of much like, you know, having to decide on whether you use UIView or CA Layer. It's like now you need to port your code over to use it. Except this time you're going from ASIC Display Kit to Apple stuff, and probably the semantics and maybe the concepts won't exactly match up. So you have to do some redesign there and reevaluate the trade-offs that are made. But of course then probably because you're using ASIC Display Kit because you want to be fast, and maybe your UI is actually not acceptable without it. It sounds like maybe paper, like they, if they couldn't use ASIC Display Kit, maybe they wouldn't go with that UI whatsoever. Yeah. That said, that in 2 or 3 years' time, our phones would get ever faster. So it could be a thing where in 3 years' time, Facebook doesn't continue revising it. Apple releases their thing, and now you have a big rewrite, have you? But it turns out that them using the slow path, you know, the new slow path, it's now fast enough because hardware is caught up. I don't know, because, I mean, Apple just... they did a new iPad announcement today, and apparently they're basically still selling the A5, like iPad Mini 2 or
basically the iPad 2 rebranded.
Yeah, and smaller hardware. So so maybe that's a not safe bet, since Apple seems to be giving us 16 gigabyte phones with 1 gigabyte RAM and stuff like that. That they seem to be kind of not as aggressive in the hardware. Attacking as we would ideally like, but
well, they give you powerful hardware. They just keep shipping the old hardware.
Yeah, that's as well. A good point. Yeah,
and I think it's a little different than that. I think the problem is if you use this framework 2 releases down the line, maybe 3 or 4 releases down the line, your software won't work anymore. Your code won't work with the new. Like if you say, well, I'm just not going to compile it against, you know, iOS 12, that's fine. But if you do, stuff will break. I'm positive of it. This is using enough. This is complex enough. This is relying on certain behaviors enough. I'm almost positive that it will break if it doesn't keep getting revised. And it's complex enough, this code, that someone who's just an app maintainer, an app writer, they don't want to have to dig into this. The guts of this complex system just to make their app continue to work. Now, I think that's a bad bet. Mm. I don't think you can guarantee that it will keep working. And I really don't think most people would want to have to be in charge of basically diving into this complex code and making it work when they didn't write it and when it's 5 years old. No, I don't think that's going to be feasible for most people.
I think that's a good argument.
So, alrighty. So we'll see you next time.